This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can read his articles at examiner.com.
Hey guys, I'm joined here with Ton Stoffel. He blogs at the Age of Treason, and so welcome to the show. So you've been on VOR a while back.
Yeah, it was back in 2008. Hi, Robert. Thanks for having me on.
So what is the you talk about your blog, and how would you sort of introduce yourself and your blog to just the average person just listening?
Well, I put it right at the top of my blog that I'm a pro-white blogger. I come at it from current events from a pro-white point of view. I'm a white guy. I advocate for white interests, and in particular, I'm interested in Jewish influence and the negative, the deleterious effects that it has on whites. That's my
focus. I remember you wrote about it. You come from an interesting perspective because you're a staunch critic of Jewish interest, but you mentioned before you also have Jewish family.
Yes. Well, I started out probably in 2003 being kind of amazed, well, 9/11 really amazed at what had happened. I wasn't politically active at the time. And then 2003, the invasion of Iraq was another straw on the camel's back. And then finally in 2005, after Hurricane Katrina, I said, this is crazy, and I needed to vent, and I had been venting to some friends via email, and so I just moved it into a blog so that it would have a larger audience and maybe have more permanence to it. And at first, I gravitated toward the conservative, neoconservative worldview, muscular defense, and we've got to, you know, these people attacked us, and we've got to do something about it.
And that was before you started your blog.
This was when I started my blog. This is the kind of thoughts that were going through my head. It was an instinctual.
Because I noticed on your site, Age of Treason, you do have a picture of the ruins of the World Trade Center.
It's 9/11. Yeah, that's what really triggered me, triggered the blog, even though it was several years more before I started blogging. Yeah.
So then you mentioned on your site that you're a pro-white perspective on Jewish influence, globalism, the immigration invasion, and the Islamic Jihad, and the tendency towards treason they inspire. So you started out focusing on the Islamic issue.
Yes, well, in the war issue, 9/11, and without digging into 9/11 itself so much, because it was already 3 years or 4 years in the past, but race, the black racism that I saw at the time, you know, blacks not liking whites and constantly complaining, that annoyed me. Although I still at the time, when I first started blogging, I didn't think of myself as a racist. I didn't think that what I was doing was racially oriented. I didn't think of myself as an advocate for white people. It wasn't until about 2007 that I really realized, hey, you know, I'm a white guy, and it probably would make a lot more sense. The world would make a lot more sense if I just looked at it from that point of view. And once I did, a lot of the confusing, contradictory things suddenly evaporated, and a lot of things became a lot more clear. And in particular, the Jewish issue became a lot more clear.
And you brought this up. If it's kind of private. Your private life, you don't have to talk about it, but you did write about it once. So how is your family? You said you have Jewish family. How do they know about your views on those issues?
Yeah, my wife, her father was Ashkenazi Jew, 100% Ashkenazi Jew. I never met the fella, what I understand is he was a good guy, an upstanding person. I have met her grandparents. They're both passed away now, her Jewish grandparents. On her other side, it's European, so white. She identifies as white. I don't really want to get into my personal life, the details, but I can tell you it was difficult to face this issue. When I started to realize that seeing things through white eyes and as a white advocate or as a white person, that I had to face these things. And it's mostly Jews that are assaulting us, that are attacking us, that are causing our problems, blaming us and for their benefit. And when I think of Jews, when I say that, I don't think of these in-laws of mine. I have two in particular that I'm sweet on that I love.
So you're obviously you're not referring to everyone who's Jewish, but you mean the big the political leadership or these big organizations like ADL, SPLC, the politicians, the media types, the bankers, and all that.
Sure, but I acknowledge that they're also joined by lots and lots of little Jews, too, that identify as Jews. When they circle the wagons as Jews, they're all Jews. And even my in-laws would probably disown me if I told them what I actually think. And I don't care. You know, at first it felt to me like, oh, gee, I should hide from this. I should keep my thoughts secret. But I have no fear of telling them what I think. In fact, the same anger that they would express, it would be based on the fact that they think it's bad for their people that I feel this way, and they would be upset for their people. Well, I have exactly the same anger, so right back at you. I don't fear in any way having that conversation with them. My wife, though, is very, very distressed by the possibility that I would ever say such things to them. So I don't have much contact with them anyway. I mean, it's really only every few years that we run into each other. And it's easy to have a civil, light conversation with people if that's all you really want to do. So, you know, I'm not running away from the issue, but I really, out of deference to my wife, I don't confront it either. But when it comes to confronting the issue of what am I talking about? Am I talking about every Jew? Do I hate all Jews? I think that's a silly thing to argue about because Jews themselves identify who they are. They hate you if you have anything bad to say about, even just if you try to qualify it down to just, I don't like the ADL. I don't like.
Yeah, I mean, just mild.
Then all of the Jews come out of the woodwork to attack you anyway. So all of those people who would attack me, I don't like. I consider them all enemies. So,
well, the thing is, I mean, I think it's in their culture that they actually believe, and a lot of their leaders, a lot of the leadership and intellectuals, Jewish intellectuals, they believe that their philosophy is that any mild criticism is a slippery slope to like Auschwitz. They've actually said that. That's the stance they take.
Yes. They have another saying, a philo-Semite is just an anti-Semite who doesn't know it yet. They have all sorts of quotes that you could find that really – they have a very strong identity of their own, and it involves hostility toward the other. And the funny thing that I've noticed more and more – I keep finding more and more examples of it. Once you're aware of it, you can see it for yourself, is they project that onto everyone else. They criticize white people for being afraid of the other. You know, we don't like Obama because he's a black man. That's true, I think. But they don't like Obama either. And they argue about whether Obama is good for them or bad for them. But it's always, of course, in terms of
I think you're right. Some of them. I mean, majority of them voted for Obama. Some of them like Obama. Some of them dislike Obama. Some of them like Republicans, whatever. But it is true they do. I mean, they always ask themselves who's best for the Jews, and I think we should be kind of the same way.
Likewise with their criticism of Sarah Palin, of Pat Buchanan, of Ron Paul.
I wouldn't put Sarah Palin shouldn't be put in the same category as Pat Buchanan or Ron Paul. But they may feel the same about her. That's what you're getting at.
They're in the category that these are people Jews hate because they're white. They just are too white for, you know, they alienate Jews. Their behaviors, their the kind of people that they appeal to, the audience, the typical Sarah Palin voter, the typical Romney voter, the typical Ron Paul voter. And the funny thing about Jews is, of course, you're the one that's to blame for them hating you. So they turn it around and they say, you know, Ron Paul hates the Jews. And that's the title that they give to their screed then against Ron Paul and how bad he would be for Israel how bad he would be for the Jews.
And that shows you, I mean, Ron Paul, if anything, Ron Paul's just like I view him as just an individualist. Like, everyone should be viewed as an individual. But that shows you how kind of psycho a lot of those types are. I mean, I think it's not just some people say that they're kind of playing a game, but I think a lot of them, they genuinely believe Ron Paul is some kind of closet Hitler. And I mean, a lot of those like rabid neocons like David Horowitz called him a vicious anti-Semite. Ron Paul's basically he's an individualist. He thinks you should judge each person on an individual basis.
Yes. Well, that's projection. That's Jews projecting their own hatred for anyone who they think is not pliable or not manipulatable or is doing something that is against their interests. And, you know, the big one with Ron Paul is he wants to cut off foreign aid to everybody, wants to bring the troops home. And, of course, for Jews that think that the best thing for Israel and for their people is that America continue to wage war in the Middle East and send billions of dollars a year to Israel, that is an outrage to them, and it means that Ron Paul hates Jews because they're thinking purely in terms of what's good for the Jews. Now, you had an interview with Ryu Gaiden a couple of
weeks ago.
And I was very interested in that because I've seen Ryu's comments on the web sometimes, and he occasionally links to my blog from the blog he's at now. And you had a good several good things that you mentioned during that interview that I thought we might touch on as well. One of them was labels and white nationalist in particular, and I remember you were saying that you don't like to call yourself a white nationalist.
I don't object if someone calls me that. That's fine, but if I think labels prevent because people shut people off with labels, even if the liberal conservative thing. Like, I don't want to talk to him. He's a liberal. I don't want to talk to him. He's a conservative. I mean, I don't. If someone's described me as a white nationalist, that's fine, and sure, I'm looking out for what the interest of European peoples in America and abroad in Europe. But I just try not to focus. I try to not focus so much on these labels.
Right. Well, I agree with you that labels have power. Language is important. And white nationalism to me, I think, is it's a word of abuse. It can be used as a word of abuse, and it is in common out in the mainstream. White nationalist is what they say when they describe somebody like David Duke. You know, white supremacist is another one. It's similar to racist or anti-Semite or hater. Nobody wants to call themselves a hater or racist.
It's like these terminologies. I'd rather someone actually explain their view, because these terms are so loaded, like racist, anti-Semite, xenophobe. I'd rather people be specific. Like, does this person hate people of a certain group, or do they feel that there's or do they acknowledge that there's differences, or do they just prefer being with one group? That's we have to be specific.
Well, let me give you a quick defense of white nationalist or white nationalism as a label, and that is that unlike a word like racist, which is or hater, which is very difficult to defend. I don't think white nationalism is hard to defend. First of all, there's nationalism. And even though nationalism itself has a bad rap in the mainstream, it's not difficult to defend the concept of nationalism. In fact, if you're talking to a Jew or arguing with a Jew, you could simply say, well, do you oppose Jewish nationalism? Because that's all Zionism is. That's all support for Israel is. It's support for Jewish nationalism.
Yeah, so, even the most liberal multiculturalist Jews, most of them. I mean, there are some exceptions, but a lot of them do support Zionism or Jew, which is, you're right, it's Jewish nationalism.
I think nationalism is a natural human instinct. It's a natural progression from caring about yourself to caring about your family to caring about your extended family, your tribe, your clan, your nation, your race, and then finally human beings in general and life in general. It's a sort of onion of layers there. And
I got a comment on that. There is something. Do you know the blogger Ruben Hayat? He's a pro-white Jewish blogger. He had something he came up with. It's called the circle of racism, where it's basically what you said. You have yourself, you have your family, then you have your ethnicity or race, then you have your country, then you have humankind. And out of all those things and then you also have your gender, but out of all those things, the racial part is the only one that's taboo. So he calls it the circle of racism with these layers. So that's basically what you're saying.
Yes, and I would say nationalism is sort of a sub-racial organization because you can have several white nations, I mean the various nations of Europe, and there's some blur there about definitions in Arthur de Gobineau's time. He considered race to mean nationalism, to be equated. You know, it was the German race and the French race and the English race. Race at that period of time had a finer grain to it than today. Race is literally black and white. Anyway, as far as white nationalism goes, I don't go around shouting that I'm a white nationalist, but I certainly don't run away from that label either, because I am a person who believes in nationalism. I believe it's a natural human instinct, and I think my people are white people, and so of course I want I want a nation from my people, exclusive to my people, where Britain for the British and Germany for the Germans, France for the French, white country for white people, run by white people for the benefit of white people. And that's all white nationalism is.
Yeah, I basically agree with what you're saying. So you talk about you identify the enemies and what do you see as the different enemies and their kind of their goals and their reasons for, we talk kind of about that, but their goals and their reasons for opposing what is known as white nationalism.
Well, globalism is one of the enemies. So the globalists, people who think that nations are not important, they're nothing but obstacles, or at least that's what they say. The internationalists, globalism, internationalism, fairly synonymous. That's the natural enemy of nationalists, is these people who want to tear down borders, who want to be free to move jobs wherever they want to flow and people wherever they want to flow so that they themselves can benefit from it. And there's several different mindsets that fuel
factions.
That.
There's one side of things driven purely by economic greed, and then there's sort of a left wing of that driven by kind of a Trotskyite internationalist or cultural Marxist ideology.
Yeah, there's a bit of a conflict there, though, between the left, which tends to be anti-global, and it's a cognitive dissonance. And that's one of the things I wouldn't say – I haven't thought through completely, so I don't have much to say about that. But there's a big Jewish component of two, of course.
Both of those original sides, definitely. But Well, there's a kind of conspiracy model, like the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the conspiracy type stuff, or do you just see it as more kind of happening more as a trend? Because obviously they are overrepresented in both of those globalist camps.
Well, the conspiracy is what's good for the Jews. That's the conspiracy. that to be a Jew is to think in those terms. And there's another part to it, which is we've been horribly victimized, our people, for 5,000 years. We've only survived as a people because we've stuck together against these horrible anti-Semites that have tried to kill us all this time. And I think what's especially instructive for white people to know is that the last 2,000 years of that Jewish history, it's specifically European peoples that they think are their oppressors. And that's the Jewish version of history in a nutshell, is that the Jews are the eternal victims of the eternal white oppressors. That's a nutshell of white Jewish relations for the last 2,000 years, at least from there.
Yeah, well, they think. I mean, people talk about a conspiracy, but I guess it's just it's an agenda. So much of it's out in the open. So I think it's bad. I think we don't really need these secretive conspiracy ideas. Like I mentioned, the protocols, when there's so much stuff that's out in the open. But you basically summed it up there. They're very paranoid that any kind of nationalist movement among European peoples will lead to another sort of Hitler, like another Hitler.
Right. Well, or pogroms. Yes, and they tell this story of blood libels and just the horrible way that they've been treated by Europeans for all this time. And it's always very one-sided, of course. It was for no reason whatsoever. It was just stupid, crazy, evil white people that got their torches and pitchforks and treated the Jews bad. And the other point I wanted to make is that that's sort of the core of it, the core of the conspiracy. But then you can imagine all the emergent properties that come out of that. Now I'm a person who thinks this way, has this identity, and I'm in charge of a television network. What kind of shows am I going to green light, and what kind of shows am I going to trash can? And that's what you end up getting with Jewish media control. You get all of the stuff that would be wholesome and healthy and glorify and give us great goals and ideals and great feelings about ourselves as white people. Those all go in the trash can, and shows that glorify non-whites and whites debasing themselves and self-abnegating, those are the sorts of things that do get onto the screen. And that's because of who's doing the green lighting at the top, as well as, of course, who the writers are, the producers, and that too, that's important, who's funding it and so on. So when people talk about this conspiracy theories, I think there are real conspiracies. And by the way, Jews actually do get together and have meetings where they discuss what's best for the Jews. There was an incident recently where an American ambassador who was a Jew was in at a conference in Europe about anti-Semitism. And he said something controversial. I forget what it was now exactly. He basically said that European anti-Semitism, meaning white anti-Semitism, was totally irrational and really just stupid. But Muslim anti-Semitism, which a lot of people are getting upset about lately because of the influx of Muslims into Europe, that was partly understandable, or at least more understandable, because after all, the way the Israelis are treating the Palestinians. And that created a firestorm that made it all the way back here to the United States.
The thing with that is, it's actually way more taboo to criticize Jewish power or Jews in the diaspora than to criticize Israel. And I guess that's interesting, because you can kind of criticize Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. I mean, that's somewhat taboo, but occasionally you'll see like a sob story about the Palestinians in the LA Times. But saying anything about talking about the Israeli lobby, or saying anything about the POW influence or dual loyalty, that's like the most taboo one, not so much criticizing Israel itself.
There's a reason for that, and it would be bad for the diaspora Jews if you were to do that. Complaining about Israel, usually when it's coming from Jews especially, it's from the point of view, and this touches on that Roth blog that I wrote recently, the Roth Vice blog, what the point there is that Jews criticize Israel on the basis that whatever their criticism is, they think it's not good for Jews. You know, they think Israel is not good for the Jews. And in Roth's case, he thought it's not good for the Jews to pin themselves to one place, to one nation, when they can have it all, basically. You know, he's basically a Jewish supremacist. He thinks that Jews can have their country and they can have the whole world, too. Weiss, on the other hand, is more of a liberal. And what is liberalism? But, you know, this pretense that everybody's equal, we should all live together, we're all just one human race. That's liberalism, today's Judeo-liberalism. And he sees Israel as violating that those liberal tenets, and so they deserve to be criticized for the same reason that racists anywhere deserve to be criticized. And, you know, he is basically doing it from that point of view. He thinks it's bad for Jews.
Well, yeah, the irony is this sort of racial egalitarianism that they've promoted for most of the 20th century is kind of backfiring against Israel.
Yeah, well, I believe it backfires when Israel is actually harmed in some way by it. So far, it's just a lot of negative press and not even a lot.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Israel is obviously not being challenged, but there is growing anti-Israel sentiment on the left, much more so than on the right, except for some people on the alternative right, but most of the opposition to Israel in the U.S. and Europe is actually on the left.
Yes, but were there any anti-Israel candidates from the Democrats?
Absolutely not. But I'm thinking of people like Cynthia McKinney is a good example. But she ditched the Democrats for the Green Party.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I have not been tuned into mainstream politics because it just seems like a farce to me. I don't pay too close attention to it. I do pay attention to things that touch on Jews attacking whites, you know, when they criticize Palin or Buchanan or Paul on the basis that I can see is, you know, from a Jewish point of view, that this person isn't good for the Jews. Or Obama, too, I often blog about issues there that touch on the white-Jewish fault line. But that's the only care I really have for mainstream politics, because I don't think we're going to be able to vote our way out of the problems that we're in.
And we'll get back to that after the break. So it's time for a break, so please stay with us.
We'll be back with The Stark Truth after this break. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called for an embargo on Iranian oil, saying sanctions on Iran must be intensified due to the country's nuclear ambitions, as a tense standoff between Tehran and Washington continues. The Islamic Republic warns it will block the Strait of Hormuz, a vital world fuel supply route, if its national security is threatened. A move the U.S. says could lead to military action. For more on this, we are now joined from New York by Caleb Maupin from the International Action Center and Anti-War Group. Thank you for joining us. Now, if you don't mind, let's start off with Iran. It's been under international sanctions for years, and Western countries are still calling for more. But what effect can these new measures possibly have?
These new measures against Iran are just part of a continued repression of the Iranian people, punishing them for the fact that in 1979 they rose up, they overthrew the U.S.-backed Shah, U.S.-backed dictator, and they took the oil for themselves. The U.S. has never forgiven them for that, and they continue to seek to isolate and threaten Iran. And that's why I'm excited about the February 4th National Day of Action coming up, when people all throughout the United States are going to take to the streets against these sanctions, these assassinations of nuclear scientists, and these threats of war, because the Iranian people have the right to control their own oil resources. That's what this war is, these threats of war and this continued isolation is really about. It has nothing to do with fear of nuclear weapons.
All right, moving back to the sanctions, though, if the EU does impose a new embargo and the Strait of Hormuz is shut down by Iran, what global economic impact could that have around the world?
Well, we saw what the sanctions on Iraq did in the lead-up to the Iraq war and the invasion. And they resulted in thousands and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of deaths of innocent Iraqi children that starved to death. You know, this is the 1%. I'm proud to be part of the Occupy Wall Street movement right here in New York City. And this is the 1% of the world, the ruling elite, the people who own the banks, the factories, the oil wells, and all of that. And just like they're waging war on working people here in the United States, they're waging war against the Iranian people. They're waging war against people all over the world who want to stand up against them. And that's why I am so excited about the upsurge going on. My enemies aren't in Iran. My enemies aren't in Africa or in Asia. My enemies are right here in New York City on Wall Street. It's the banker elite that runs this country, and it's time we stand up against them. So any threat of war against Iran must be strongly opposed. Any continued efforts to isolate them, it can only hurt the people of the world, and it can only benefit the ruling elite.
Now, you mentioned that the war in Iraq, and also we know that tension is rising all the time in the standoff between the U.S. and Iran. Is this just saber rattling between the two, or is Washington really prepared and really...
Return to the Stark Truth, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back. I'm joined here with the blogger Tom Stoffel. So you just, before the break, you pointed out that you don't think we can vote ourselves out of this mess. I tend to kind of agree with that. So what are you do to, before... You do talk about the Iowa caucus, and just sort of comment on that briefly, and then we can sort of move on to the topics voting of why we can't vote ourselves out of this mess.
Yeah, what I thought was interesting about the Iowa thing, I first heard of it through the Andrea Mitchell quote, you know, that Iowa is too white. And I thought, oh, here's another typical expression of Jewish anti-white disgust or distaste. And in the mainstream, and you know, how are people going to react to this? How are white people going to react to it? And of course, the conservatives really have no response because they can't say, hey, Andrea Mitchell, there's too many Jews in the media, which is what they should have said to just put her back on her heels in the same terms that, that she expressed in. But I was curious when it came down to the answer to the critics of that did criticize Mitchell that. Well, she was just quoting other people. She was just quoting critics. And I started to dig and to find out who are these other critics. And I never did find a whole bunch of critics. I found one fella, Sulzberger Jr. in the New York Times, who had pretty much said the same thing that Mitchell had a few days earlier in print. And then I found a long article several weeks earlier from a fellow named Stephen Bloom. And that, I think, was the source, certainly was the most perfect, long-winded explanation or expression of Jewish distaste and disgust for the white people of Iowa. And it really was more, when I started to pick through what he was saying about these Iowans, it really seemed to me he was picking on white people in general, white Americans in general, maybe rural, some of the things were tuned toward rural, but it really was yet another expression of Jewish alienation and disgust with white people. And I highlight things like that because I want white people to understand that Jews don't think of themselves as white, not in any real sense of identifying with white people. They may say they're white, as we talked about before the break. They get really upset when you accuse them of dual loyalty or being Jews, even just calling them out as Jews. They get very upset about that because that's the reality. That the jig would be up if everyone realized that these people are in it for themselves. They're not. They talk high-minded about what's good for everybody, what's good for the world, what white people should do, especially, you know, you should feel guilty because you enslaved the blacks and you gassed the Jews and you killed all the Indians and stole their land. When they speak to us and to guilt trip us like that, to blame us for those things, it helps that they pretend that they're white people, because they want to pretend to be a voice of authority from our own kind when they speak to us like that. And we have to realize they're not speaking to us as peers or as compatriots. They're speaking to us as a minority with their own self-interests in mind, trying to guilt trip us so for their own best interests, not for everybody's best interests, and certainly not for our interests.
But then the flip side of that is if they say they're white, then the black and Latino underclass will view them as privileged white people. And I think there are a lot of blacks do view them as privileged white people.
Yeah, some of them do. I think blacks actually have a better they differentiate between Jews and whites better than white people do. But Jews do a lot of damage control too. That I think I haven't even really investigated, but I know of several examples where they lobby together, they conference together to try and smooth out their differences, and it goes way back, the relations between Jews and blacks and the aid that they extended to blacks, the civil rights movement, the freedom riders, teaching in black colleges. It was Jews who were lecturing us in the later days. I mean, the early people opposed to slavery were white folks, but certainly after the Jews came to the country, they saw the opportunity there to drive a wedge between black and white in this country, and they identified, I think, honestly identified with the blacks, because they saw there go us, but for the grace of God with a dash in the middle, black people, the way they're treated, we could be treated that way too if the whites ever decided to that we weren't white. So
and for those same reasons, they side with Muslims in Europe.
Oh yeah, well that was something that came out of Breivik. When Breivik's attack happened, most of the mainstream didn't discuss Jews at all. Those Jews weren't really involved. But if you paid attention, like I did, to the Jewish back chatter, what they were concerned about was what this all meant for the Jews. And what it meant to the Jews was this was an attack on multiculturalism. Breivik stated very clearly that he was attacking multiculturalism and that he considered multiculturalism his enemy and multiculturalists his enemy. And Jews know that they're big on multiculturalism. An attack on multiculturalism is an attack on the Jews as far as they're concerned, just like an attack on Wall Street is an attack on the Jews. An attack on liberals at a certain point is an attack on the Jews.
Yeah, there's been politicians who've made comments, like Wesley Clark, who's actually very pro-Israel, pro-Jewish. He got in a little trouble for making a comment. He said something about like the New York establishment.
The New York money people. I think that wasn't that Ron Paul who said that? Maybe it was Wesley Clark. But I thought Wesley Clark is like half Jewish anyway.
I think he is.
That's like when Oliver Stone made some controversial comment.
Yeah.
He's half in the tribe anyway. So, you know, neither guy really probably paid much of a price for it. Anyway, the point about the Breivik thing was one of the expressions that several Jewish commentators latched onto was describing the Muslims as the new Jews. That was their way of seeing it. They saw Breivik's attack against multiculturalism in Norway, where there's only a sprinkling of Jews, but there's lots of Muslims flowing in, that Breivik was trying basically to ignite a race war to get the Muslims out of Europe and save Europe. And the Jews see this through their own Jewish lens, as, you know, again, back to the 2,000 years of being oppressed by the white man, that the Muslims are now the stand-ins for the Jews. Because the white man killed all the Jews and got rid of them 70 years ago. There are no more Jews in Europe, according to the Jews. And so now the Muslims are the new Jews. And this is their expression that came out of the Breivik attack. And it's just one more reminder that they don't think of themselves as us. They aren't us. they are themselves, and they're out for their own interests. And that is, if there's one takeaway from my blog for the last couple of years, that's the takeaway I would like my readers to get. And I think that's what a lot of my readers do get out of my blog. I get a lot of comments from people saying, boy, you really opened my eyes to this issue.
So back to what you were saying. You said we can't vote ourselves out of this mess. So what do you predict happening? I mean, I don't know if you're like a trendscaster, like all these guys.
I don't like making predictions.
Trendscasters, okay, but I mean, but you look at the future. We can't vote ourselves out of this mess. So what's going to happen?
No, the future is going to be violent, one way or another. Either white folk are just going to continue down the path we've been going, and we're going to go out with the whimper, but it's going to be amidst a lot of violence. I mean, there is already a lot of violence. The media puts a lid on a lot of it because anything that's anti-white is played down and broadcast only locally. It's not, you know, nationwide news. Whenever anything happens to an illegal immigrant or whites beat up a black or something, then it's, of course, nationwide news. But my point is, there's a lot of violence against white people already in this country. That's what white flight is all about. It's white people wanting to get away from that violence, doing what they can to get away from it, even to get away from the potential. I mean, you don't even have to be a victim to look around you and see that people are being attacked for being white, that this is not safe anymore because of all the Mexicans or the blacks or the Muslims that are moving in. We just don't mix. And a lot of people don't even have a conscious understanding of it. They don't understand the racial dimension of it, especially white people, because they've been lectured their whole lives not to think in racial terms. You know, you get phenomena like the Tea Party, which is a white phenomena. It's a bunch of white people adhering to a bunch of principles that are generally white and seem to scare away anybody who's not white, which is why non-white people don't show up to those things. And yet those white people are sort of in denial about it being white. They want to prove that it's not racist, that it's really just wanting smaller government and wanting to pay less taxes. I see it as white people expressing in a grassroots style their collective political interests. And the media dogs them for it, just as white people, says they're too white. You know, they just don't like having a black president. They just don't want to pay taxes, or they want small government. They say they want to stay in small government and don't want to pay taxes, but they want their Medicare and they want a white president. And it's just bizarre, the double standard that you see the media treat white people to, until you understand that the media isn't a bunch of white people, and it's not owned by a bunch of self-hating white people. It's owned by a bunch of Jewish people who don't like white people. So, of course, they don't sympathize. So,
yeah, that's what you get at. You talk about the suicide meme.
Yeah, back to the suicide meme. It's meme. Meme is sort of analogous to a gene. A gene in biology is the basic encoding of a particular protein or eventually becomes a behavior or a something real in biology. In the idea world, they call it a meme. It's a idea of Richard Dawkins created this idea of meme. But the idea is basically that ideas can mutate and be transmitted, replicate from person to person. And what we're engaged in here, other than the low-level violent warfare in our cities, the crime and so forth, is we're engaged in a meme war. You know, the things that I write about, Roth and Weiss and Stephen Bloom, Andrea Mitchell, they're waging a war of ideas. You could say the war is over already, that it's been won, that the Jewish version of history has prevailed, that that's what our kids are learning or being taught in school, and most white people go along with it. You could say that the battle is lost. But as long as we have the ability to speak out, whether it's in a blog or on VOR, or even just speaking to our friends, as long as we can speak freely about that without being thrown in the gulag, the war's not over. We're still able to fight this meme level of war. We don't even have to build explosives or pick up guns. That time will come when we're no longer able to express ourselves through memes.
Then that's what happened in Europe, and obviously there isn't you don't see a violent response in Europe where people are being locked up for speaking their views.
People are locked up for questioning the Holocaust, and people are locked up for inciting racial hatred.
Or for very mild stuff. Did you hear about that nationalist leader in Denmark? His name's Daniel Carlson. He was arrested, thrown in jail. He said something like, this country doesn't need any like low IQ Africans, and he was thrown in jail just for that. So it's not just the Holocaust.
Right.
It's
inciting racial hatred.
Yeah, or the woman in England who spoke out on the train.
Right, but you can say whatever nasty, crappy thing you want about white people, and that's inciting racial hatred too, at least in a literal sense. But what you have to understand is that racism, and I put little scare quotes around that, mock quotes, is really just a white thing. It's a crime that only white people can commit, and that's something that white conservatives don't really seem to understand. They talk sometimes about reverse racism, or they talk about black racism or Hispanic racism. And yeah, literally, if you have a sort of universal definition of racism in your mind, that racism is just people of one race treating people in another race badly or thinking or saying bad things, yes, then it would be true. But the real way that racism is used in the media, in the schools, is that it's a white thing. You only call white people racists. You don't call Jews racists. You don't call black people racist. Even though they have their organizations organized for the interests of their own race, for their own group, they're just not called racist. In fact, if you try to call them a racist, well, then you're just proving that you're a racist. Because, again, it's like the rubber and glue thing from grammar school. You try to call them on these universal white people can't help but think in these universal morality terms. And you then are surprised that, wait a minute, I thought I was pointing out black racism, but I'm the one being called the racist now. I don't understand how this works. And they don't understand, white people don't understand, because the morality that these other non-whites operate under is not a universalist morality. It's not a morality that applies equally to everyone, where everyone is all the same. We're all born equal in the eyes of God. It's Jews and what's best for Jews, what's good for the Jews. And they've taught that, although they didn't really have to teach them too hard. They taught them more language and technique. The Latinos and the blacks have basically learned these tricks from the Jews. Certainly the language and the ability to organize, and the fact that they're protected or not attacked for organizing, whereas white people would be. The Jews would sue you out of existence, as they have. The Southern Poverty Law Center is probably the spear point of that effort, suing white organizations.
So you wrote about you wrote Bartomeu and the suicide meme. What were you going to say about that, about Bartomeu?
Yeah, well, the suicide meme is something that I've it's sort of a specialty of mine. I noticed that first of all, out in the mainstream, there is no problem. The only problem is racists, right? The white race is not dying. The only people who care about the white race being having any problems are people who we call racists. They're haters. But there is a small segment on the internet where we're able to talk freely, and there's a whole jungle of different spheres there. There's the manosphere and who are upset about feminism, and there's the Christian sphere, and they're upset about what's happened to Christianity, and there's the white nationalist sphere, and there's this HBD sphere, the human biodiversity sphere, and they're all semi-overlapping with each other because they're all sort of griping about and grappling with a lot of the same problems.
The same enemies or forces are behind a lot of that same stuff. So you mentioned Bartomeu. Bartomeu's not really, he's not a white nationalist, but his site's very interesting because it represents an overlap of he focuses more on the manosphere, but kind of is like an overlap of those two. That's why you mentioned his name.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't like Ferdinand Bartomeu. I don't like the whole gamer thing. I think it's kind of snarky and nihilistic, and it's not healthy. Chasing after women like they're meat and thinking in whatever materialistic mechanical terms you have to get that meat just bothers me. It's not our tradition. It's not a healthy. It doesn't produce a healthy family, I think, in the end. And that should be our goal, is to have healthy families and raise children, raise the next generation of people to replace us, rather than importing hot Asians or, you know, whatever happens to tickle your fancy, which a lot of these guys do. They fetish hotness rather than caring about their own group of people.
Well, sexuality is by far the most powerful human driving force, I think, among males and females, but I think more so among males. So I do think it's important to address. And obviously, I mean, reproduction in women, we have to look at, like, how are we – we're failing to reproduce ourselves. But I just think it's kind of a response from a decadent society where a lot of those people are coming out of. But I guess it is true that, I mean, some people who have learned game have been more successful. So it can be used for both good and bad. There's one blogger who I think said that – I forget which one said that game helped him with his marriage. But that's kind of – we do have to address the sexuality is the most powerful human driving force, I think.
I won't argue with that. And I'm not really an expert in the whole gamosphere, manosphere thing. I just know that it semi-overlaps what I am interested in. It came to my attention that he had written this – particular blog post, "Whites Are Their Own Worst Enemies," and I responded to that, and I analyzed it, and I saw it. I was glad, basically, I wasn't a fan of his site, because it's all snark. It doesn't even make any sense when you try and analyze it logically. It's completely hypocritical. For one thing, he says, you know, the only people who think that Jews aren't white are you, silly anti-Semites, or what, I forget what he calls us exactly, white nationalists or anti-Semites or whatever. And then he goes into how it's all white people's fault, and it's definitely not the Jews' fault. So right there, he himself is making a differentiation between Jews and whites. And this is a common theme in the suicide meme. It's usually it's put forth. I should sometime identify what the elements are, but I can do it quickly, I think, here. It's blaming white people, and specifically as a way of excusing the Jews. It almost always is motivated by or explained in terms of, you know, it's not the Jews, it's you people. You people are to blame. And they'll bring up the Civil War, you know, that you were the ones who brought the slaves to America, you freed the slaves. That was white people. That was before Jews ever came to this country in great numbers. Things like that.
That's true. I mean, white people did bring in there were Jews more involved in the slave trade. I think that was more in Brazil than in the U.S. Whites have done a lot of horrible things to themselves. But the question is, what's a bit more important an issue, the suicide meme or the other issue that you talked about?
Well, I think let's get it straight. It's not suicide. It's genocide. I think genocide, if you wanted to put a label on what's happening, a better fit for what's happening is genocide than suicide. Because suicide involves, first of all, a conscious effort to kill yourself. That's what suicide is. And it's funny that in the small segment of the internet where people discuss how they don't want to kill themselves, how they don't like what's happening, that this whole idea that it's suicide – it even comes up, because as I say, in most of the internet, most of the media, there's no problem.
Well, we're basically out of time, but we'll pick up this topic on part two of this show. So I'd like to thank our guest for being on, and that's all we have for tonight. So take care, and we'll be back with you with part two.
Thanks for listening. Robert Stark will return next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Visit our website at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.